For as long as I can remember, going back, the talks that I've given here for the last 5, 6, 7 times I've been here, I think for the most part I just talked. I gave long talks on the 5 faculties and things like that. And then I'm going to be gone for the next few Mondays. Next two Mondays, Eugene Cash is going to come and give the talks. And Eugene Cash is a Spirit Rock teacher. And he's going to come and talk about Buddhism and sex. And a topic I haven't talked about since I was younger. Quite a bit younger. And so my guess is he's not going to take a lot of time for questions. Because there's a lot to say about the topic. So I thought what I'd like to do tonight is to give you a chance to ask questions about practice or about Buddhism or whatever seems relevant. And partly to give you a chance to, because I imagine you haven't had a chance for a while. It'd be nice to, if you have any questions. And also it's helpful for me because to kind of get a sense of what's important for you or what's going on. And so that's what I came here today to do.
The insight dialogue that was on Saturday was awesome and very powerful for me, and it was one of these things that kind of helped bridge the gap between practicing and actually maybe taking it to life. And I just wanted to give that feedback that I was sad that he wasn't going to be in the area for the next year. Cool if there were, you know, I can feel already it's only been a couple of days and I'm already like forgetting it. And that's something that really needs to practice, but it's cool for a way to have some sort of ongoing thing to actually make that stick in my brain.
Mm-hmm. I could imagine that there's some, I was told there were some 60 people there. And so it was a big group. I don't know how many came from IMC, but there's probably quite a few. And I could well imagine that there could be a group coming out of that, an ongoing group met weekly or monthly or something. He has a little book, a booklet. I don't know if he gave it out or provided it there about his, and people could go through his book, do the exercises, talk about their experiences of practicing daily life. I think it'd be very rich. And it might also be interesting to contact him and tell him that that's the intention, is to start a group. And he might have all kinds of ideas and about how a group like that could operate. And he might actually even be a long-distance kind of advisor for a group like that.
I just had a question. What time is the workshop this evening lecture on Sunday?
On Sunday afternoon, it starts at 12:30. 12:30 to 4.
And
what's the topic? Buddha Nature, Mara Nature. He's written a book on Mara, which is, if you translate it very loosely, is translated into English as the devil, the Buddhist devil. And so he's gone back and looked at the ancient texts to see what's actually how Mara is talked about, and then written a book about Mara. And his book's called Living with the Devil. Though translating as a devil is probably not so good for a Western audience, people who are used to Satan. There's a number of, Stephen will talk about it, but Mara is an interesting character. And he's kind of depicted different ways at different times in the text. The word Mara is cognate or comes from the word death. You know the word English, mortality, or morto in Italian? It's a wonderful way that Sanskrit and Indo-European languages are all connected. You can see that connection, that word. So Mara comes from the word. Please repeat the question. The question was, what time is the workshop on Sunday? And this is the answer. You know, being a Dharma, there's an occupational hazard with being a Dharma teacher. And that is, the longer a person is a Dharma teacher, the more they talk. And every opportunity, you know, you just talk and talk and talk and talk. So all she asked was a time, right? And here we go on. So should I go on, or should we just go back to the time? So Mara is, and you know we have Ajahn Amaro, the monk up in Ukiah. His name is Amaro, which means means not, so not death or the deathless. And we have written on the wall up there. Probably most people don't see it because it's meant for the Dharma teacher sitting here. Mm-hmm. It's Amata Dhatu. And the way that Pali works, the Amata, the A is negative. Mata is just a different way of saying, a different kind of way that Mara kind of, you know, is conjugated, I guess. And it means deathless. And Dhatu means dimension. The deathless dimension is a synonym for nirvana, for enlightenment. And it's there because it's supposed to remind whoever sits in the seat that the Dharma teachings always inclines to the deathless. Leans in that direction, inclines in that direction. So Mara is, you know, so it's kind of connected to death. And one American translator or Western translator translates Mara as that which is deadening in our experience, in our lives. And Mara is also sometimes considered to be the ruling god of the sensual, the heavens of the sensual world. The heavens of the sensual world. See, Buddhism has everything, you know. If you want to find it, you'll find it. And so they have not just one heaven, but they have Buddhist, traditionally, they just adopted a Hindu or Indian cosmology of the time. And there were, so I don't know how many heavens there are, but at least 33. There's something called the 33 heavens. But I don't even know if that covers them all. But anyway, there's three major categories of heavens. There's the heavens of what's called the sensual world, which is the world we live in. We live in a sensual world. And then there's the heavens of the fine material world that's connected to, it's related to very deep states of meditation, the first four jhanas. So it's very refined states of material existence, so-called. And then there's the non-material heavens. And it's said sometimes that Mara is the ruler of the sensual heavens. So it's kind of like he's kind of like a god. And his job description, the way he operates, at least the way he mostly operates in the text, it seems like one of his main job descriptions is to prevent people from getting enlightened. So when you get up in the morning and it's time to meditate, and instead you decide to watch the reruns of Friends, 6 o'clock in the morning, because that seems really important. Some Buddhists would say, you know, that's Mara that got you right then. So it's kind of like, it's kind of a way of personifying the inner psychic forces that interfere with our spiritual growth. So that's at 12:30.
Is Mara male or female?
Mara, as I know, is usually male. And however, Mara has his daughters. And I forget the name. You know, Stephen Batchelor can tell you the daughters, but they usually have names, something like, I don't know, but they have kind of their personification of different forces also. And then Mara also has his army that can help him. And it's quite awesome, his army. You don't want to have to face his army. Unless you have practice. Because then, you know, your practice can withstand all kinds of things if you rely on it. Yeah?
How is Mara manifested in other Asian cultures?
I don't know so much about it. You'd have to ask Stephen. Maybe he knows. I don't know if he knows that much about other Asian cultures. I don't know what he studied. Yeah, I don't know if he studied Mara in those traditions. I mean, you have to ask him when he comes. I don't know how much Mara appears. I'm not familiar with Mara kind of appearing in the Zen world, in Japanese Buddhism that I had contact with. But any here people who know about that question? Does Mara appear in Tibetan Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism? Yes?
In Biography of the Awakened One, writes about Mara appearing to Buddha, not just in the battle of enlightenment, but at various other times when Buddha would feel doubt.
Right.
So that's, I don't know if that's an answer to this question, but there are other apparitions of Mara when you're frightened or doubtful.
So in the early tradition, there's a fair amount of discussion of Mara. But the question is, in the later tradition, and when you get to Tibet or if you get to Japan, and I have this feeling Mara kind of drops away. It's not so important in those traditions. And it's kind of a peculiar thing. And there's a book on Mara and the Judeo-Christian devil, the Western devil. Because I think it's kind of peculiar to have religions that kind of, apparently, that to have these two characters, like the devil and Mara, that kind of personify evil in this kind of very particular way that it does for these two traditions.
Satan was originally the accuser.
The accuser?
There was this, the original Hebrew word meant the accuser, and he wasn't politicized as evil. Maybe started about 150 BC.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know so much about Mara, you know. I mean, that's the study of it. So Stephen's really the expert now. So, you know, come and talk to Stephen. One of the ideas that in the early Buddhist tradition of someone who has become enlightened or liberated is that that person can no longer is no longer seen by death, sometimes it says no longer seen by death, and other times say no longer seen by Mara. Mara cannot see a person who is practicing deeply, and the idea here is that in the psyche, in the mind of someone who's spiritually mature, there's no hooks there which Mara can kind of find to latch onto. So there's no, greed or hate or fear or self-identity or self-defense, you know, those kind of things that Mara will latch onto. So it said you can, the person will not be seen by death. It's a very powerful image. Yes?
I don't know if this is too personal of a question, but I'm always interested in other meditators' experiences. So I guess I was wondering, you practiced as a monk for many years. How did you know when you were clear enough to become a teacher, or how did you know to go back into the secular world? Or, I don't know. Do these questions make any sense?
Well, it makes a lot of sense. So, I don't know if my answer will make sense. So the question is, a personal question, kind of me, I guess, of how is it I decided, how did I become clear about whether to become a teacher, or how did I become clear about kind of leaving the so-called secular, spiritual world, or this monastic world, and enter the secular world where I live now, you know.
How did you even know that you had the clarity of mind, finally? I feel like a lot of people go into that world, the spiritual, sort of monastic life. Sometimes I think because, not always, but sometimes because they're not able to function as well in the regular world.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm totally making a generalization.
Is there anybody who can? Well, I can tell you a little bit personally about myself. I was very attracted to meditation. I started meditating and I felt kind of home very quickly in it and very pulled into the world of meditation. And very quickly, as I started meditating, I felt a kind of level of personal integrity. That's how I understood it for myself at the time, 25 years ago. A kind of sense of personal integrity that I was kind of unfamiliar with, except for things that happened in my early childhood. And so at some point the question for me was how to extend that integrity, that feeling of personal integrity, self, into my daily life. And I felt early on that the boundary between meditation and daily life, the mind, is the same mind. And so it's kind of arbitrary division. And so the sense of deep well-being or integrity that I felt in meditation, I wanted to extend into my daily life as well. And I noticed that the when I went to San Francisco Zen Center, that the environment there, the practice of the community there, seemed to help me in bridging that divide between meditation and daily life. Because it was quite challenging for me, because the friends I had in college and all that, you know, they weren't being very supportive of me trying to live a different way or come from different values or come from that integrity that I had. So going to a community for me was very important, because I had the support of other people who were trying to do that. So for me, it was kind of really important to have that. And so it became a quest for me to try to expand the range in areas of my life where I could extend that integrity or live from that place of integrity. And so oddly enough, the idea of going to a monastery, which I did eventually, a Zen monastery, was not so much to practice meditation so deeply, but rather was go to an environment where I felt was most conducive to try to spread what happened in meditation into my daily life as thoroughly as I could. So I went to Tassajara in 1980, my first year there at the Zen, I spent about almost 3 years there the first time I was there. And the first year I was there, I spent a lot of time reflecting about what I wanted to be this kind of fundamental orientation or purpose of my life, what I would be engaged in. And specifically, I tried to look at the intention behind what I wanted to do. And I had two basic ideas. One was to go back to college, get a master's in soil science. I have an undergraduate degree in agriculture. And because of my training as an undergraduate, I was very aware of the catastrophic state of the soils of the world, the amount of erosion going on. So I wanted to go back to Berkeley and study soil conservation and go to places like Nepal and various places and try to help conserve soil, because that was really important. And the other thing I wanted to do was somehow I felt that the Buddhist practice that I was involved in was a way of addressing suffering also in a very different way, and addressing suffering kind of within rather than kind of without. And so these were the two kind of things I was considering. You know, should I somehow devote myself to Buddhism and try to support and help alleviate suffering in the world through that, or go back into college and do soil science? And both of those motivations, both those ideas, I didn't trust. Somehow I didn't trust someone who wanted to do good in the world. They just, you know, and you know, the motivations why they do that, and probably just self-serving or something. So I spent a year of my life thinking about this, reflecting on it, looking at myself. And I did it at the monastery a lot during the days off. We usually have one day off every 5 days or so. And so I would go for hikes, long hikes in the mountains, and I would reflect and think about it. And I spent a lot of time. And this, one of the conclusions I came to after a whole year was that I felt my intention was pure, was good. There was some aspect of my intention to be of service and help, which seemed pure, which seemed kind of natural or right. And that made a big difference to me to kind of identify that. And then at some point I had a very powerful experience that what happened was the abbot, who seldom came to the monastery, came during the summer, and there was a chance to get an interview with him. And because he was there, it was a catalyst for me to think about these questions some more, what I wanted to do with my life. And I was sitting there, kind of looking over the Tassajara River, a beautiful kind of, you know, nice idyllic river going down. And I was thinking about it once, a certain kind of strength in my thinking or my engagement with it, because this possibility for an interview. And suddenly I felt this shift in my body. My whole body changed. And then I knew what the answer was. And afterwards I put words to what that answer was, you know, why it made sense, why I wanted to do that. But it was really this inner shift that happened. And a few times in my life when I had major decisions to make, it was this inner shift, this change in my body that was the answer, not something cognitive, you know. And the shift, what it came to was that I decided that I was going to devote myself to Buddhist practice, the world of Buddhism, because I wanted to address suffering in the world. And so this is the words I added to it, right? So what it meant was I was going to become a Buddhist monk. And the words I kind of added to why I wanted to do it was that I wanted to address suffering at the root. And there's a lot of ways of helping people in the world. I can go out and kind of do soil conservation work and would help a lot of people, maybe very, very effective in ways people are starving or whatever. But even people who go from starving to having a lot of food, when you look at human life, you see they're probably going to suffer also. Suffering is pretty deeply ingrained in the way people live their lives. And I felt that I would always feel some, because I knew about, you know, what Buddhism points to, the possibility of some deeper engagement and transformation of suffering, I felt I would be unsatisfied if I didn't really try to meet suffering at its root or support or do something there at the root of suffering. And so my only way I knew how to do that was through Buddhist practice. So I said, okay, I might not be a very good monk. I might not be able to help a lot of people, but at least I have the satisfaction of knowing that I can meet suffering or try to meet suffering at its root rather than kind of, you know, surface manifestation or something else. So I went to the... So it was that kind of engagement it took, you know, to get clear. A year worth of reflection and thinking, a lot of meditation, a lot of kind of special environment. And then... So I became a monk, and it was the idea of, really it was a lot to do with the idea of being a service, to help other people. But I thought I was going to be ordained as a monk. And then right when I was ordained, right afterwards, the San Francisco Zen Center changed the title of the ordination from monk to priest. And boy, was I disappointed. And that's not what I signed up to be. I was kind of monk type. So that's what it was. And then I... but the thing about the Japanese monastic tradition, monk or priest, that's very different from almost all other forms of Buddhist monasticism, is in Japan, priests or monks can be married. So so that sort of, in a sense, kept me into the secular world because, periodically I had girlfriends, and eventually got married. Then the thing about becoming a teacher. So then I asked my teacher, then the abbot, if I could be ordained as a monk, and he asked why, and I mumbled something silly. I don't remember what I said, but I didn't seem very cogent to me. But he said, in my amazement, he said, "Yes." What? That was easy. I thought I had to. It was a big deal, right? And he said, "Yes." So then, okay, good. And then I saw, it's going to take years before I'm ready to be ordained as a, because you have to do all the sewing and preparation for it at Zen Center, and then there were so many priests at Zen Center, and so the route to becoming a teacher was really slow, and I calculated, well, if I'm ever going to become something like approaching a teacher, I calculated it's probably going to take me 20-25 years of being here at Zen Center because there are so many priests being trained ahead of me, and there's a particular position back then that only two people could have a year, and there were 50 priests ahead of me, so it was this bottleneck, right? And so then that was something like in June, and then in September I got this word that I had to have everything ready to be ordained in December, and I thought it would be like a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 year process before I got ordained, and so then suddenly I found myself ordained. It happened in January. And I was very happily ordained and living that life. And then I went to Japan for a year and practiced there. And went back to Southeast Asia and practiced there. And came back and spent a year living at Green Gulch and being what's called the Eno, which is the person who's kind of director of the meditation hall. And it was kind of beginning to kind of be kind of a teacher kind of role. A little bit. And then I went down to Tassajara to be the head monk, this thing that was only 2 a year kind of thing. I didn't have to wait 25 years for it because things changed at Zen Center quite a bit. And so I did that in 1988, the head monk position. And after that, you kind of more clearly become kind of like beginning to kind of this little bit of a teacher. And I felt like I wasn't ready to be a teacher. And even though I was beginning to be put in those kinds of positions. And I felt I didn't really know about Buddhism enough. By that time I'd spent about 10 years, pretty much full time, in meditation monasteries. I'd left, you know, maybe a week or two at a time for once or twice a year. But otherwise, those 10 years were just living in meditation monasteries, pretty intensely doing intensive practice. And I hadn't actually done much study of Buddhism. I didn't know much about Buddhism except meditation. And so I felt that if I'm going to be a teacher, I have to be better prepared. I have to know more about Buddhism. And there's no time to read and study in the monastery. So I decided I would go get a master's in Buddhist studies in order to be better prepared for that kind of role. But I didn't even know if anybody was going to ask me to be a teacher. And part of the idea of getting a master's was that since there's not very few positions in America for Zen priests, I thought, well, I have to find some form of livelihood. And I wanted to do it close to Buddhism. So if I get a master's in religious studies, I could at least teach Buddhism, enter a class of Buddhism at a junior college. And that was kind of the thought behind me. And then while I was in Hawaii, then in 1990 or so, 89 or so, 89, about 89, I was invited by Jack Kornfield to do Vipassana teacher training. And I wasn't really thinking so much I was going to be a Vipassana teacher in some big way. I wasn't even thinking, just, you know, you don't turn down an opportunity to train with Jack Kornfield, something like that. It just seemed like a great thing. And then I came back to here to study at Stanford to get my doctorate in Buddhist studies. And then I was invited to start training to become, to get Dharma transmission in the Zen tradition, to kind of be kind of authorized as a full-time, kind of full-fledged Zen teacher or whatever. And simultaneously, this is doing this Vipassana training with Jack Kornfield. And it just kind of evolved. I had this feeling of just kind of evolving. You're kind of just morphing into this. It wasn't like any clear choice exactly. But what happened especially with the Vipassana teaching, was that I first came to our group, and now we aren't big. But all these people come here, and we have this building and things. But we started this group started in Menlo Park in the mid '80s. And I was asked to join it in 1990 when it had moved to Palo Alto. And there were about 12, 15 people who came on a regular basis, as I remember. And I was asked to kind of come be the teacher of it. And, you know, it's one thing to talk to 12 people in someone's, you know, kind of living room. It's something else to talk to, like, a room like this, right? I mean, I couldn't have done that in 1990. I would have been petrified to face all of you and have you look at me and... You know, it's just like pretty, you know, daunting task. Yeah. But you know, 12 people I could cut and deal with. And so slowly, the group grew. And so because it grew slowly, my role as a teacher, kind of my capacity to be a teacher, kind of grew slowly with that. And so I was very clear that I want to support people in practice. That's what my life is focused on doing. But the day of becoming a teacher at the level of I am now, I don't think I ever could have planned that or thought about doing that or hoped to do that. It was just kind of something that evolved over time. And I still don't know how good I am. I mean, you know, I don't know why you're here. but I'm very clear that as long as there's, you know, people who want me to teach or what, you know, people or people who want to practice, what I want to do with my life is I really want to support people in their practice. It's so important. And to give people the opportunity to practice. And it's more important to support people in practice, in their practice, than it is to teach people. And I'm very clear about that. So hopefully teaching is a support, but you know, it's important not to let the teachings, both giving teachings and hearing teachings, get in the way of practicing. So I don't know, hopefully that was okay to give that long answer to that question. Yeah.
What was the
and the role of your intention throughout that process, like the process of, you know, more your role of teacher developing. I mean, did your intentions change from your original ones, or were they refined? Or, you know.
So was my did my intentions in teaching change over time?
Where you ended up. I'm just thinking about like that.
Well, I never ever planned to be in Redwood City. That wasn't part of the plans in my life. You know, I was headed to the country. That's where I thought I was going to end up. But here I am. So, you know, so some of the details, you know, changed. But the but the underlying intention, I don't think has changed so much. The idea of practice and supporting people in practice and practicing myself and addressing suffering, meeting suffering, and trying somehow address it. I don't think that's changed any over. You know, that's what I feel my life is about. That's what, you know, I want to do with my life, and I feel very fortunate that this is what I've been able to do. So certainly some of the details have changed, you know, but how it's manifesting itself. But is that kind of your question?
It always amazes me, like how I make, you know, or I make a lot of these plans, or I, the intention is the same, but I make these plans of how I think it's going to look like, and then it never ends up looking that way.
And you know, so the reason I'm in Redwood City or here in the peninsula is very clearly because there are people here who are practicing and are interested in practicing. And it, as the group and first in Palo Alto grew and grew, I felt a lot of loyalty and to that group of people who are practicing or are practicing, and I just wanted to be as supportive as I could and help, and also I could, you know, it's hard, at some point also it's very hard to imagine going off someplace else and being able to have this very rich life of teaching. And it's phenomenally, it's a great privilege, you know, to have this kind of life and to be teaching and to get to think about teaching and the teachings and the practice and meet people at this level and their lives. And I mean, I feel amazingly blessed in having this, being able to do the kind of work I do. But it's because people, you know, are practicing. Yes. There's a few things that the question is, what's the connection between meditation and study? Is that kind of simple, you know, studying, you know, all the lists and all the teachings and all the philosophy? And I think study can be very helpful, but it depends on how much you do. I mean, you can study too much Buddhism. For example, you can get a PhD in Buddhist studies. And so it's possible to study too much, but I think that probably the first and primary functioning of study is a form of encouragement, to encourage and inspire us to practice. So it's kind of an encouragement, and a lot of people find that that works for them. They read a certain amount and it encourages them. Another reason for study is to be challenged, to be offered ideas that are different than your own. And then be challenged by that and grapple with those different ideas. In particular, ideas about who you are, or really deep ideas of what you think you really need in your life, and what we hold on to. And so sometimes Buddhism is a mirror. Studying Buddhism is meant to be a mirror, so we see ourselves better. It's not a window into so much like a new world that's outside there, but more like a mirror that helps us see ourselves. And so when we study, it's part of the way to study is to say, how does this relate to me? How do I see life better, or reflected in this? And sometimes we study, you know, to learn techniques. you know, certain level of technique is helpful, or you know, understand the map or the terrain of life. And so, you know, so we read, says, oh, it's really good to count your breath 1 to 10. I never thought of that. Okay, it sounds like a good idea, so I'll try that for a while. So there's all kinds of techniques you can learn. And so I think study is good. And the question is, you know, how much study to do. And that's probably a very personal thing. People who are really dense and slow probably need to get a PhD in Buddhist studies in order to let it sink in. And some people kind of, you know, catch it really quickly. And, you know, the expression is, you know, once you get the message, you hang up. I don't think, you know, I don't think that a lot of study is necessary. Buddhist teachings, I don't think the amount of teaching that you really need to understand doesn't require a lot of sophisticated study. There's a lot of sophisticated study you could do, but I don't think the basic things that people really need in order to study and practice well doesn't require a lot of study. So,
Could you say a few words about intention in the relationship to planning and thinking and willpower? It seems like I'm intrigued by the relationship between those two, those several things. Also interested in intention. What is intention?
So the question is, what is intention and what's the relationship of intention to planning, thinking, and willpower? Intention is a very important topic in Buddhism. It's so important that it's probably safe enough to say that you know, Buddhism is a religion of intention. Of intentionality. Intentionality is very important. Or if anything, Buddhism kind of says there's no self. And but if anything qualifies as self, it's your intentionality. Intention is very important because, for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is that intention, the shape of our intentions, the moral quality of our intentions, shapes our character, shapes who we are into the future. And so one of the primary kind of things that Buddhists do in their spiritual life is to be the custodian of their own intentions, looking at the quality of their intentions. Two people can do the same thing, but with very different intentions. So, for example, as we leave here today, I might open the door for you as we go out, and someone else might open the door for you when you go out some different day, and I might open the door for you to show you what a wonderful teacher I am, and really show you how great I am and how kind I am, and you better notice. And someone else might open the door because they're just kind people. They just kind of think it's nice to open the door for someone. Maybe your hands are filled and you can't open the door. It's just being helpful to someone. And there's a world, they're both doing the same thing, right? But there's a world of difference between the person who's doing it to show off in some way and the person who's doing it just to be kind, right? So we see, oh, what I want to do now is open the door. What's my intention in opening the door? And so it's a kind of inner thing. What am I really trying to do here? Behind what I'm acting on, behind what I'm saying, what's the intention? And is that the quality of intention then that, it said in Buddhism, creates our karma, which means creates kind of the momentum or the shape of what happens to us or who we are, our character and our experiences into the future in a very big way. So looking at our intentions is very important. So the quality of our intention and spending time and analyzing it is very important. And some of that involves thinking. Some of it involves feeling, intuiting. So intention at this level is deeper than our plans. So, you know, I can plan to go shopping tomorrow, but then the question is, what's my intention in shopping? You know, and it could be all kinds of things, right? Or what's the intention that I want to have when I go shopping? And some things we can do, you know, it could be the intention is to, you know, to go get food for my family. That's enough. Or I can say, okay, my intention is to get food for my family, but maybe I can infuse this with some other intentions. Maybe I can go into the supermarket and try to make a little bit of a difference in someone's life there. Maybe I can just, you know, if there's opportunity. You know, part of shopping is try to lighten the day for the checkout clerk. You know, let's, you know, so they're kind of infused in extra intention in what we're doing. But even like the intention, you know, to go and feed my family, which, you know, you can ask, you know, what's the intention behind that? You know, what do you, you know, and you find maybe deeper than trying to feed the families, is there some deeper intention of to offer our love, our support, or, you know, to really be helpful to someone in our close life. And so to recognize that there's deeper intention besides just going out and shopping, you know, oh, the cupboard's empty, and why there's no milk in the refrigerator, and kind of be annoyed, you know, and why didn't someone go shopping, and I just rush out and, you know, be annoyed and come home because here it is, you know. I mean, that's a certain intentionality, right? And it's kind of a lost opportunity. But if you can kind of pay attention to the intention and try to make a course correction, what is my intention? How do I want to go shopping? Do I want to go shopping in a huff? Or do I want to kind of connect to some deeper motivation besides irritation or something? And so planning, you know, is thinking, planning is all part of that. Will? I don't know what will is. Will is kind of a peculiar Western thing. You know, and I'm not so deeply steeped in Western words like will. I like the word willingness. I don't really like the word willful. But that's kind of maybe idiosyncratic on my part. I know some people feel will is very important, and that is a sign of maturity. Personal maturity is to have a very strong sense of will. And if that means some real ability to kind of stand behind our intentions and act on our intentions, follow through on our intentions, I'm very happy with that word. So is that at all helpful? Is that in the ballpark? Or was I being long-winded? You want to ask more?
Well, maybe just say this. I had a teacher who's, she says to me sometimes, you know, don't think about doing A, just have the intention of doing A. And she makes a big distinction. You know, I should ask her about it too. I'm just curious what she would say about it.
Let me know what she says. So, last thing, yes, please.
Do you have any insight as to how you actually would bring intentions into your meditation practice without getting overly carried away with your thoughts about it?
Oh, I think you can. I think it's, you know, it's best when you do Vipassana meditation to let go of, or best you can, reflection, contemplation about plans and intentions for the future or your deepest intentions for your life. Having a quality time in our life to think about those things or reflect on them or sit quietly with them is very important, I believe. So some other time besides meditation time to think about our intentions, look at it, feel our way into it, ask our question, what is my intention here? What's my deepest intention? Or what's behind that intention? For what purpose do I have that intention? There's a lot of questions a person can ask and kind of, you know, and see what bubbles up as we do that. But in meditation practice proper, looking at our intention happens all the time. So if we're sitting here, for example, and our legs are uncomfortable, and we decide to move our legs, there's intention there. And so then you can, before you move, you could actually ask yourself, you know, look, what is the intention in moving? Well, the first thing you say is, well, you know, so I don't hurt my legs anymore. But if you, let's stay there a little bit and look more deeply. What's the intention? And you might discover that the intention is aversion or impatience. That's what's coloring the intentions. I just hate pain. I'm going to escape from it, get rid of it, or stop it, or something. And that's kind of a considered kind of an unskillful intention, to intention that's based on aversion. Or, you know, a person can move based on other intentions. It could be wise. I recognize if I sit any longer this way, I might damage myself. I think it's wise to move. So we're moving not because of aversion, but out of wisdom. So in meditation itself, we can look at the intentions that that arise in that situation itself. Or, you know, it could be more subtle than moving. It could be the mind wanders off thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. And then once you notice that's what's going on in meditation, there has to be some intention in relationship to that. One intention can be to let go of it and come back to the breath, or an intention to settle oneself on the breath or really focus on the breath. There's intentionality involved in making that shift. And so a person can, again, look subtly. You know, what's behind that intention? Is there some sense of aggression? I know people sometimes will push away distracting thoughts in an aggressive way in meditation, and then they kind of jerk their mind and pounce back on the breath, you know, in a very aggressive way. And then the intention is colored by some kind of aversion or greed or, you know, something a little bit unwholesome. So it is, you can see that, you know, stop and look. What's the intentionality? What's being expressed here in some deep way? In the way my mind moves in meditation itself. Can I move my mind? Can I engage in the activity of mind in ways that are conducive to a healthy mind, a sane mind, and a peaceful mind that's more settled and quiet? I think that's an important and aspect of meditation. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? Or you want to say, ask more?
Can I follow up this a little bit?
Please.
Okay. Through meditation, at least for me, this is from my engineering, you come in touch with, you know, places I've suffered. And often what it touches into is places where my suffering is maybe resulted in somebody else experiencing a fair amount of suffering that touches me. So then it becomes pretty clear that you have something you need to repair or make right. So this is where the intention comes in. You know, you really want to know, you know, what's the right thing to do here? How are you going to make it worse? Or, you know, so you want to. To me, it seems like you want to hold that in your meditation because that would be a way to come to a clear answer on it. Yet you don't want to get wrapped around a whole thought process that's, you know, and kind of get lost in that again, because that's basically what got you there to begin with. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm
trying to. Yeah, there's a lot of things a person could do. One is to get yourself as quiet and calm as you can in meditation, and then from that very calm mind, let yourself think about it. And if you find your mind getting contracted or agitated, then let go of the thinking, get yourself calm again, and then begin thinking again once you're calm, seeing what you need to do. And so you always maintain that calmness when you're thinking. A calm mind, a concentrated mind, is much more creative than an agitated one, much more intuitive. So you might think much more clearly. And also, thinking when you're deeply calm allows some of the more intuitive aspects of the psyche to operate also kind of in parallel to the thinking. So there might be other things going on kind of offline in a sense, you know, outside. You know, your thinking might not be where the answer is going to occur, but you kind of need to think in order to let the offline things kind of percolate. The other thing that some people will do is they'll sit and get as quiet as they can and then have a question around their issue. And then at some point when their mind is very quiet, if they can get that way, to pop the question and then don't think about it actively, but then see what bubbles up. It's kind of like dropping a pebble in a pond and you see how the ripples out. So you kind of just drop this pebble of a question. You know, should I call this person up and apologize? That's the question. So you drop that into the pond of the mind and you don't think about it and you see what happens. It might be 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later, something bubbles up and says, of course. just a very clear kind of answer. Or maybe, oh no, you shouldn't do that or whatever. That's, you know, one way to do it. Another approach which can be helpful is that there are probably emotions connected to this. And so rather than thinking about it so much, enter into the world of the emotions connected to the issue and try to clarify the emotions in some way, kind of really be present for them, bring presence, clarity, to really feel and sense and explore those emotions and let the emotions unfold or unravel or move in some way that might be very different than how things would develop if you were thinking about it. And then do that for a while, and then after a while you might get some clarity of what's going on. You know, and your question is, you know, will I do more damage by trying to repair it? sometimes, you know, if someone has a wound, even our best intentions can sometimes be like salt on the wound for them and can cause further damage. So we never quite know. But one of the things that's very important for Buddhists is to at least be clear that our intentions are wholesome or skillful or good. And then sometimes we take the risk. You know, I think I know that my intention is good. I'll try to do what I can. Maybe it's appropriate to apologize, and hopefully I won't hurt the person anymore. But I know, at least I know my intention is not to kind of, you know, stick him one more time. Does that make sense? So intentionality and reflection, deep contemplation when you're calm and settled, being well in touch with that part of the psyche that makes decisions and has choice, can make choices, is really important when you look at how to be wise in your sexuality. So you're prepared for next week. When Eugene will talk to you. So thank you very much.